Good evening to everybody, and thank you for accepting our invitation to start this Triduum of Lenten Reflections before we enter the proper Triduum of the Passion of our Lord Jesus Christ. This year we have the pleasure of having Father Jim Corkery with us. He's an Irish Jesuit from Limerick, and Father Corkery joined in 1972, if I'm not correct. Yeah. His studies took him to the University College Dublin in social science, then in Germany for philosophy, and Milltown Institute Dublin for theology. After his ordination to the priesthood, he completed a licentiate and a doctorate in systematic theology at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. He has been teaching theology for over 20 years at Milltown, and has published in the areas of fundamental theology, grace, and social spirituality. In 2009, he published the book Joseph Ratzinger's Theological Ideas, and a year later, an interdisciplinary co-edited collection of essays entitled The Papacy Since 1500, From Italian Prince to Universal Pastor. He has also been active in various roles in the Irish province of the Jesuits over the past 40 years. He's at present also a superior of one of their communities in Ireland. That's a little bit about Father Jim. I'm sure we'll get to know him much better when we hear him and when he shares his insights. These Lenten reflections are being recorded by Campus FM, and I'm sure they'll put them up on their website at a later stage should you wish to rehear or maybe share them with your friends. So all I'm going to say is, sit back, enjoy it, and let us truly enter this Holy Week and prepare ourselves for the Passion. Thank you.
You're very good to come out after a day's work on a Monday night to an unknown quantity. But I hope it'll be worthwhile. I'll do my best to make sure that it is. It's very nice to be here. I thank Father Michael for his invitation and his introduction. I have never been to Malta before. We Ireland peoples should stick together. So I'm very happy, but I wish I came from an island which had skies the color of yours. I've hardly ever seen blue seas, but today it was really nice. So I'm very happy to be here, and I hope that these 3 days that we have together, we can walk together and grow together. The first thing I will do is I will look at the time. That's not for my sake, it's for yours. The title that was given to the talks for these days, by agreement with Father Michael, was Approaching Easter in Troubled Times. There's hope there, because we're approaching Easter, and Easter is always with us. But we would be fools today to say that we don't live in times that in very different ways are quite troubled. So a Christian always wants to have realistic hope, not blind optimism, and therefore I put the two together in that way. I'll say a bit about the troubled times, but of course I will say a bit about the Easter hope as well. An Easter focus also is ultimately important, because in Lent we're moving towards Easter. Lent is referred to in the liturgy as the season of grace. When I arrive at it, I don't always feel like that. I feel like dropping 2 sizes in the trousers and engaging in other muscular spiritual exercises which usually don't succeed. But Lent is about much more than that, as you well know. But it is a season of grace because it looks to what is so important and what is so central to our faith. So I will attempt, as we approach Easter these days, to be aware of the troubled times we live in, but at the same time, to be sure that this trouble is not the last word. At the beginning, I'd like to put before you an overall perspective that might guide the reflections over the 3 days, and that will serve as a sort of backdrop for things that I will say. I want to say that in the becoming human, in the incarnation, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus, we can be sure that God is active. Often we live in a world where we feel God isn't running it very well. He's not up to much. Stuff is happening that he doesn't approve of, and he doesn't intervene. There are disasters. But I think it's quite central to Christian faith that God is active in human history, and always has been. We know this from the stories in the Old Testament. God is uniquely active in Jesus and in all the stages of Jesus' life, not just his passion and death, but all through from the incarnation to the resurrection. The climax of his activity, of course, is what we celebrate liturgically this week, that outpouring in love, where Jesus ends up in this shape, the most vulnerable shape for a human being, in which he gives everything, and also because of that giving, we're able to receive everything. In the past, we may have had the idea about Easter, as we prepare for it especially, that it's that time of difficulty, say the Holy Week, you know, where we remember that Jesus died for our sins, and in an awareness of that, we become conscious of our imperfections, and this is true, we are imperfect, but also loved by God. And so we can look at the events of Easter, and indeed the coming of Jesus into our lives, we can look at it remedially, can't we? He came to fix things. He came because we're in trouble. Or worse, he came because we messed it up. There's an element of truth about that, but it's also, and this is where I'm trying to put a broader perspective, the arrival of Jesus among us, God's presence among us, is not simply remedial. There was a discussion in the Middle Ages that many of you would be aware of, a speculative enough question. This is what theologians do, you know. They get paid to do this. They said, would Jesus have come if we hadn't sinned? And some said, no. He wouldn't have needed to. And others said, yes. And why? Because the lover desires to be with the beloved. Love impels unity. And God who is us towards, would have spilled out anyway into this world and would have stolen close to us in Jesus because of love. So that's the perspective I want to put in the background, not denying that he also came to heal and save, because there is something about how God feels about us, first and foremost, which assures us that he would have come among us, even if we didn't need him as a remedy. There are two people who have talked about this in the 16th century, both Spanish mystics, both poets. One is St. John of the Cross, with whom I'm sure many of you are familiar, and the other is somebody I know pretty well myself, St. Ignatius of Loyola. You've probably heard of him, too, in this university chaplaincy. Well, they both took a viewpoint on this question, but you'll be surprised to know that I'm taking a holiday from St. Ignatius tonight, and I'm going with St. John of the Cross. John of the Cross sees the creation as the gift of the Father prepared for his beloved Son. And in a tender dialogue that John writes in a poem, one of the romance poems, he has a dialogue between the Father and the Son where the Son is saying, I have prepared for you as a beautiful gift, as a bride for you, this creation. So here the incarnation takes place so that the Son of God can become one with his radiant bride. The perspective is romantic. Out of love, God creates, and he gives that beautiful gift of creation as bride to his Son, who exults and rejoices in her beauty and comes to be united with creation. It's a very romantic vision and a very Christian one. Nothing remedial about it, though. Because creation is good, God seeks to be one with it, and his Son becomes human to realize that relationship. St. Ignatius Loyola, whom I also admire and try to follow, he depicts the three Trinitarian persons. You probably know this, the Meditation on the Incarnation. They're in heaven looking down upon the whole expanse of the earth, and they see how we're stumbling about pretty foolishly, having made quite a mess of things, and they even say going down to hell. And so we need someone to save us. So in their love, they decree that the Son, the second person of the Trinity, would become human to save us from ourselves and from all that has gone wrong. So their emphasis is essentially remedial. He comes because we're in trouble. But of course you will notice that the motive is the same. The motive on God's side is love. Now, of course, each of these approaches is important. Those of us who have been brought up more in the Western Christian tradition, the Latin tradition, we're more familiar with the second, aren't we? The more remedial approach. And that's why I'm bringing the other in. Because in the Eastern Church it's very evident, and because in many strands of Christianity it's also very much there. That God becomes human, not only because we need him to fix our situation, but also because creation itself is good as it comes from the hand of the Creator, even if we do stumble and fall, and God wishes to be united with this creation that he loves. There's a little text in the liturgy, which you might notice on Sundays, or indeed many days, and it's my favorite, and thank God in the new language they didn't change it. By the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. This is a theology of exchange. It's not in the first instance about remedy. Sure it isn't? It says that he becomes human by self-emptying so that we might become like him, divine, divinized, by God's lifting us up. That's not there for us to do for ourselves, but because of God's action, if you like, of spilling into our world, it is possible that we can be lifted up to his. There was an old professor in one of the universities in Ireland, very positive in his outlook, and he always spoke of God having an us towardsness. They lean out. The Father leans out in creation, The Son leans out in redemption, and the Spirit leans out and sanctifies the whole world. So God, the persons of the Trinity, are tilted towards us. It's an inclination. They like us. And they spill out, taking form in our world. It also means, because we're made for this relationship, that we have what you might call a God towardsness. I think you probably noticed this sometime in yourself, when you're not busy noticing your faults, that you are drawn towards what is holy. You are drawn sometimes through creation, or the beauty of the human face, or the struggle to forgive. You are drawn into an awareness that we are made for something larger. We are open at the top. We are permanently unsatisfiable in a way, because we are made for the infinite. So the truth is that we have a God towardsness, and God has an us towardsness, and that is why really we can be hopeful that the two of us will get on. We are made for one another. So with that as the backdrop, I'd like to say a little bit about the troubled times that we live in, to try to be realistic about all the things we struggle and scramble with. It's common enough these days to meet people who say, I feel vulnerable. I feel unsaved. There are threats out there. I feel exposed. We talk about certain things in the world as if we have almost no control over them, don't we? When I say the economy, I think of something that has its own laws and behaviors and that I could be the victim of in the morning. We had a fat Celtic tiger in Ireland who has grown very thin very quickly, and the economy has changed hugely, and with it, people's prospects and life conditions. We speak of society, society being greedy, society being selfish. We know that it has its own attitudes, its laws, its forces, and we often feel that in the face of society, there's little we can do. We speak of culture in the same way, don't we? Culture with its insidious attitudes, culture also with its possibilities and opportunities. But these are things that are transpersonal, but they threaten us. The political system, the state, even the church. We can often feel before the great institutions and the great entities that we're very puny and small. And when you say to another person who's in a difficult circumstance, well, you know, you could do something about that, they frequently feel, well, I can't really. I'm up against what's too big. If you read some of the scientists nowadays, now I say this with trembling because I know there might be scientists present here, but I was reading recently a theologian scientist called John Polkinghorne. He's an elderly Anglican, English theologian and physicist, and he recently described in a book the two scenarios that are most likely for the future of our planet. And he says like this, on a cosmic scale, the history of the universe is a gigantic tug of war between the expansive force of the Big Bang, driving the galaxies apart, and the contractive force of gravity, pulling them together. These two effects are so evenly balanced that we cannot tell which will win. Either way, the scenarios for our future are not optimistic. The universe will end with a whimper if expansion prevails, or with the big crunch if gravity prevails. And these catastrophes, while they lie 10 billions of years into the future, spell ultimate futility for the universe, and humanity will prove to have been a transient episode in its history. Not good news, not the great vision of the Jesuit Teilhard de Chardin, you remember, of many years ago. It looks that in planetary terms, we won't be around to see it, but it looks like the scenarios are bleak, if this theologian scientist is correct. And then there are still other big things that threaten and frighten us. For example, climate change. We sometimes don't know what to make of it, but there's not one of us, I think, who hasn't experienced in recent years strange changes in the weather. We who never get snow had three huge snowfalls last winter, and we have more sunshine now sometimes than we're used to. We like the latter, but not the former. We're told that changes in temperature in Ireland could come about fairly easily if the Gulf Stream shifted. And because we're so far north, we could be dealing with much severer weather, worse than we could manage. Cities that are close to the sea, you think of Bangkok, you think of places in Bangladesh and others, as well as islands in the Pacific, if I'm not mistaken, they're in almost certain surety of disappearing. Isn't that right? Certainly with the rising of waters, we also fear things like unprecedented population growth, especially in certain countries like India, and also scarcity of water, scarcity of foodstuffs, and so on. They say that the next wars will be fought about water. You might be wishing this state that I would stop, but these are things you know from the news, and it's not all bad news. There's another thing, too, that we're aware of. We've made a bit of a collective mess of the world, haven't we? Huge gap between rich and poor. We've situations created by wars and economic disasters that have huge movements of people, economic refugees, political refugees, who can't find a way to live in an appropriately dignified way in their own countries, and they're on the move. We also know, we hear that the euro that you've just joined, I believe, is on the brink of collapse. Somehow it's holding, but it makes you nervous because it's something else that you don't really have any control over. Then we know of political corruption, scandals in institutions like banks. We have them in Ireland anyway, I don't know about you here. And then, of course, even in the church. Young people are floundering, and we don't always know how to pass on the faith. And added to this collective mess, there's the precariousness of our own existence. One thing that's certain here, for all of us, is that we will not live forever. We will die. I will have a mortuary card with a particular date on it. Far away, I hope, but who knows? It's not in my control. You know the great philosopher Heidegger who talked about human existence being existence unto death. It is into that horizon that we live. So if our religion has nothing to say about death, it has nothing to say. So there's the threatenedness of personal existence, and that includes now also the threat of love relationships failing, of family breakup, of forgiveness not being available if I do wrong, and so on. For many of the things that are really important, we rely on receiving, don't we? This is a message often sent by the present Pope, that for salvation, forgiveness, love, if I could manufacture those things out of you, or whatever they would be, they wouldn't be salvation, they wouldn't be forgiveness, and they wouldn't be love. So for the really big things of life that make all the difference, we rely on others. So the human condition is a precarious condition. We often don't feel saved, either individually or collectively. And there are many problems in our troubled times which are much larger than individual problems, and so they cannot be turned back simply by individual solutions. In all of this, in this world that doesn't look saved, we need to know that there is a genuine benevolence that cares for us and that we call providence and that has this world somehow in the palm of his hands. I say somehow because there's no image that adequately tells us how to understand the truth taught well at the Vatican Council, the First Vatican Council, that God in his providence directs all things in the created world. But an image I like is this. If you think of providence caring for us, and I'm saying this now against the background of those difficult scenarios that I've described, you don't want it to be like this, like a puppet. God cannot fix the world by constantly sticking his finger into it and rejigging the laws of nature, or turning human behavior around and undoing it, and so on. If he were to do that, he would be completely failing to take seriously the very gifts he gave to the world when he created it with its autonomy, its laws, and us with our freedom. So his taking care of us cannot be a puppeteering kind of taking care. It has to be a sort of from a bottom up rather than from a top down. I imagine it somehow like this, that we are given as free human beings to run around in the hand of God, and that the hand of God is open. And so there we are, with a great scenario for our development, but with an equal possibility of falling through the cracks. But God has two hands, and when we fall through the cracks, the second hand of God, not puppeteering from above in a controlling way, but catching from below, as it were, now becomes the hand of God, in which once again, because God is crazy, we have the freedom to run about and make those mistakes and do those things, but also do the good things. And in due course, of course, there will be some slipping through the cracks, but then God's other hand is free and catches again. Now, the image is an image that I would use with young people, very young people, sometimes more than with you. But it has to be like that if God cares for us, doesn't it? Because it can't be the dominating kind. That would be not taking seriously either the way the world is or the way we are. And at the same time, you need an image of a benevolent God who is caring for the world all the time. More and more in liturgical situations these days, I am struck by readings which say that God is active. When you read Isaiah and you hear, "Behold, I am doing a new thing." And this is said to the Israelites in exile, weeping because they have lost their land, which symbolizes everything for them. And they're weeping on the waters of Babylon, and God says, "I am doing a new thing." God in Jesus did and does a new thing. Many of the Gospels that you read indicate God active and doing a new thing. So when I said at the beginning that God is active, not only to fix, but also in love, and when I was talking there about providence and care, I'm trying to say that, yes, I know we live in troubled times, and there are many things that are bigger than we can manage. Nevertheless, God is not an absent God. I was reading the book of Cardinal Martini before I came here in preparation, because it deals with the passion accounts in the scriptures. But there's a beautiful introduction to it from which I'll now read. It says, "The entire Bible is nothing but the story of the passion of God for the human being. For us, God burns with a mad, wild, crazy love, an amour fou. God is enamored of the beauty of his creature, as Catherine of Siena expresses it in her prayer called The Love That Conquers Every Obstacle." I don't often talk about the more depressing side of life, because I'm an optimist by temperament and an optimist by faith and a pessimist by intellect. But two out of three isn't bad. And I really believe that that optimism that you can have by faith is very important. It is the hope precisely that is not foolish optimism that you can bring with faith to situations that we have to truthfully admit are quite difficult. There's nothing worse than the preacher who tells you everything is fine, isn't that right? And then you return home, or to your work, or to your bank account, or to your doctor, and you find out there's a lot that's not fine. It's to have hope when it isn't. So, okay, that's the first bit, the overall perspective that God is among us as more than remedial, and that the problems that we have are not all the result of sin. We're inclined to feel overpowered and think that we have problems because we go wrong all the time. Well, there are problems that have to do with being finite. And that's what I was trying to say when I was talking about some things in the world. The mess isn't entirely of our creating. It's bigger than that. But God is among us providentially, active, and by no means doing nothing. So we have troubled times, you will agree. But now if we go back to the time of Jesus, you will notice that he had very troubled times as well. I looked at the readings, especially the gospel readings, for the 3 days that I'm with you. So not the readings that you will hear from Holy Thursday on, but for these 3 days, so that if you happen to go to Mass any day, the reading will fit with what's going on here at night. And so they really, if you read them now, they will show you how that the circumstances in which Jesus lived were troubled times in bold, and at the level of system, as well as at the level of individuals, just like I have described for us. We're reading John's Gospel these days, and John's Gospel is full of imagery of light and darkness, isn't it? It has a sense of ominousness as Jesus approaches Jerusalem. He knows he's going to get it in the neck, because he has annoyed the authorities, the religious authorities, and more. So, Jesus has committed an action in the temple. You remember the driving out of the money sellers and so on, or the money changers and the sellers. But this action was much more than stopping people doing something that wasn't appropriate. This action actually struck at the very basis of the Jewish cult. It was criticizing from the heart the very practice of the religion itself. And therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees found him dangerous. Then we find in John chapter 11 the story of the raising of Lazarus from the dead. When this happens, of course, people begin to follow him. And the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees say to one another, "Not good. Not only will he have to be eliminated, but so will Lazarus, because people are coming to take him." So they are then in this context, as Jesus approaches Jerusalem, watching for the moment to arrest him. They're ready to take him and to do with him what they will. What he has done in the temple, that action that I mentioned, was that he relativized, he questioned, he put in a secondary place much of the practice of the religion of his time, and he actually offered the forgiveness of sins on his own authority, and not because people sacrificed in the temple. Can you imagine if the equivalent kind of threat was made against our church today by somebody? We would certainly find him dangerous. He'd be on the edge, be striking at the very basis of our faith, and we would think something had to be done. So the context is, that's the context of the reading that you will find today. And in addition to that, you will find Judas Iscariot, in whose heart there is smoldering an ever-increasing desire to deliver Jesus to those who want to be done with him. So for him, the times are pretty troubled. And they're troubled at the level of the system, the entire religious system, as well as at the level of what individuals go through. If we look at the text itself that we had for today's gospel, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem and he stops at Bethany, where he has friends with whom you're familiar, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. Watch these people closely. Martha had pushed him hard, if you go back to John chapter 11, at the time of the death of her brother. But after all that she has seen and the dialogue she had with him, the full relationship and exchange, the robust engagement with Jesus, she is now happy to welcome him to her home and to prepare a meal for him. Lazarus is present at the table, and Mary comes in. You know in the Gospels there are four accounts of the woman washing the feet of Jesus, and they're all different. But I'm just dealing with John at the moment. Mary is not described as a woman who was a sinner. She's simply described as Mary. And she comes in with very expensive ointment. And she anoints Jesus' feet with it in a very intimate and beautiful gesture. Judas gets annoyed. He says, "That's a waste of money. It could have been used for the poor." Judas' heart is already turning, and his concern for the poor is pretty hypocritical. But the action isn't so easy to understand. In fact, in the text, it's Jesus who explains it. He says that what she's doing is anointing my body in preparation for the burial that is to come. Well, what you see about Mary that's so beautiful is she lives in a love relationship with Jesus. Her gesture towards him is intimate and touching, quite literally. And out of this love, she also understands his significance, and she understands where he is headed. There's a recipe for us there. Get close to Jesus, get new eyes, and you will see things in the right vision. The reader is invited to see in Mary's action a symbolic embalming of the body of Jesus as though he were already dead. You remember, of course, when John is writing his gospel, it's quite late. So he's writing with the understanding of many years after the resurrection, and he's explaining the meaning of the events through the text that he constructs. If we stay with some contrasting pairs back at the time of Jesus for a few minutes, just a little more Judas and Mary, and then I'll move on to Peter and this Mary of Bethany. Judas was greedy and hypocritical. Mary was generous and truthful. She acted from love. She got it in terms of what Jesus was about. But Judas, whose heart went elsewhere, didn't get it. On the window of the room in the Jesuit house where I am sleeping, I don't know why they put it there. I think it was there before I came, but maybe they're trying to give me a message. It says, make Christ the center of your life. Could be an admonition. Anyway, Mary did it. And in making him the center, she was able to see with the right eyes. There is something else. We don't know what Mary's life was prior to her getting to know Jesus. If she's like us, it probably wasn't perfect. It probably had hurts in it. It probably was deficient in love. But the interesting thing is that once she accepts his love and knows that she is loved, she is empowered to act freely in love towards him, and she also understands what he's at. I remember years ago working in an orphanage. We were young Jesuits, and when we turned up, the woman in charge said, you're here. What are you like? Are you faithful? Because she said, I don't want you this Friday or any other Friday if you don't sign up to come every Friday. Because these children who come from broken homes or homes where there are no parents or where parents have died, she said, they have been hurt by every adult they've known. If you're inconstant, you are useless. So she said, boys, you know what a matron is like, make up your minds now. But either you come next week and the other 51, or I don't want to see your faces again. And she was right. And the lovely thing happened that as we grew to know the children over a number of years, they grew to trust us. Because they knew, come what may, we would come on Friday. Now, we did it not because we were good, but because we were frightened of the matron. But she really loved those kids. And she taught us something very valuable. And I think it's true also about our own relationship with God. We meet many people going around, and maybe it's ourselves too, who are dragged down by their imperfections and what they have done wrong or inadequate in love. But God isn't looking at that. God loves us in that kind of way that is utterly constant. The old woman pestering God about her sins, and God said, what sins? You know, I think that Mary is an example in the gospel here of somebody who was revolutionized by love, because she took it on board. We later see the same with Peter. Peter denied him. Peter was a little bit like Judas. But the thing that really mattered, and the difference that it made, was that Peter could accept the forgiveness. It's quite hard to accept forgiveness, because it means A, admitting you've done something wrong, and B, being vulnerable. You know, I'm vulnerable to somebody else when I take forgiveness from them. So how are you doing so far? Not asleep? Okay, that's good, you know, because like make faces and sounds and move from side to side in the chair, because, you know, that's important. All right, well, Judas and Peter, again, even though I'm talking about people from far back, they're not irrelevant for ourselves. The scene that comes in tomorrow's gospel has Jesus at table after the foot washing, and he's with the disciples, and Judas and Peter are there. There are two dialogues in this part of the gospel. One is with Peter when Jesus is washing his feet. Peter says, you can't wash my feet. It's basically because Peter is beginning to understand the significance of this gesture, that he who is the master of all is willing to be the servant of all, and that that gesture of being servant, of washing the feet, is the true pointer to the significance of the death that is to come. That's what it means. Later in the gospel, there's a second gesture where Jesus dips a morsel of bread into I've forgotten what he dips it into. What does he dip it into in John's Gospel? Is it a cup of some kind, or? You all know something, but I'm not catching it up here. Anyway, a dish, I think, of some kind, isn't it? But I'm not sure what's in the dish. But he dips the morsel in.
Okay.
A dish of something anyway, probably liquid of some kind, maybe oil. And the significance of the gesture is a gesture of intimacy. If I were to do that in that context at table, to dip the bread into the dish and then to give it, as he did to each disciple, it's an intimate gesture of love, apparently. But what does Judas do? Like the others, he takes it, even though he has evil intent in his heart. So in a hypocritical way, he takes this. At that stage, things seem to get even more intense. We are told this hypocritical gesture, which would normally be an acceptance of love, is followed immediately by Judas's utter rejection of Jesus' love. We're told that he goes out and Satan enters into him. When he's gone, Jesus explains something to the disciples. He goes back to the foot washing and he says, "You remember I washed your feet." And he points to the fact that they should act towards one another in the same way. By this, people will know that they are of him. He comes back, in other words, to make clear, about 20 verses later, that the unique gesture of love which he was showing is the kind of manner of relating to people that he expects them to show to one another and to others. A unique quality of love, inspired by the love that Jesus had for his own, singles out also the followers of Jesus. I'm quoting now a Father Maloney, a gospel commentator. There will shortly be a time when Jesus will no longer be with the disciples, and they won't be able to go where he is. In that time of absence, what they are to do is to repeat the love that he showed among them, and actually to render present a lifestyle of Jesus. If you notice, I keep coming back to something, that the gospel is not just about individuals. It's about a way of living together in culture, in society, in social circumstances. Jesus has a vision and a lifestyle, and it runs counter to much of the vision and lifestyle of the societies and cultures which we construct for ourselves. I read once somebody writing about this, and he said, we are motivated by a logic of, funny word now coming up, a logic of self-centricity, as opposed to what we should be motivated by as Christians, which is a logic of eccentricity. Well, of course, many, many Christians are eccentric. He doesn't quite mean it like that. But his point is that because we can be very focused, especially in our European societies, on the individual's rights, the individual's place, we're willing to concede the rights of other people to the same things that we claim rights to ourselves. But the focus is on what I'm due. It's less on what we're due together or what the other person is due. An example in Ireland is there's only one road to the airport. I can truthfully admit that often when I'm on the road to the airport, I wonder, what are all those other people doing in front of me? They're in my way. I'll be late for the plane. I'm virtually thinking they're on my road. But my basic attitude, it's an attitude of individual-centeredness, and my idea is not to cooperate with the other cars, but to get ahead of them, to get ahead of the people in the queue, and with Ryanair, you need extra elbow room to do that. But my logic is a logic of self-centricity. If I thought maybe of cooperating with the crowds, if we thought of cooperating with one another together, we might find another way of getting to the airport efficiently, but together. But if a society is very focused on the individual and his or her rights, the logic of eccentricity will be trumped by the logic of self-centricity. And so a culture, not just an individual, could be spoken of as selfish or uncaring or greedy or whatever. So it's interesting, isn't it? What I'm trying to show is that what Jesus is doing with individuals around him is what the early Christians called a way. They are following a way, and it's a different way. We know from the Acts of the Apostles the way they cared for each other, the way they shared things in common. They were quite radical and prophetic. So it's not just about Judas and Mary, or Judas and Peter, but it's about getting Jesus' vision of things, and in a way, envisaging a different way and a different system of living together. You notice it sometimes in families, don't you? That they have a culture that is more ex-centric than self-centric. Something is working. You can find it in a classroom, in school. We sometimes find it in a community. So it is possible for a collective as well as individuals to be like this. And the good thing is that if it is so, if Christians are people who live that kind of lifestyle, actually individuals are also affected by it in the situations which they find themselves. I'll tell you a funny story. I was teaching a few years ago in Ireland, a Polish Jesuit and an Irish Jesuit. The Irish Jesuit was a bit of a lefty, and I was teaching liberation theology. The Polish Jesuit had come from a country where he remembered communism quite well, so he wasn't having any truck with liberation theology, and he was saying, that stuff isn't for me. So then I was trying to get across the idea that, of course, I'm not a Marxist or a determinist, but that your social situation can make a difference to how you would behave, so that if you have a good community, maybe you can be a better individual. So he wasn't having any of this, you see. So I said, supposing you were in charge of young students, and you heard that when you sent them to Ireland, that everyone who lived in Ballymun drank a lot of Guinness, used bad language, didn't do their studies, got low grades, whereas everybody who lived in Dundrum, they spoke like angels, they drank very thimblefuls of Guinness, they always did their studies, etc., etc. I said, where would you send your guys? And of course, I was trying to trap him, obviously. You see, he says, oh, well, I'd be quite like this. And then another guy said, answer the question, Chris. So what I'm saying is that in terms of, you know, when you come to Lent and you look at the figures of Judas and Peter and the others and so on, you may feel the call to individual conversion. That is good. But it's not everything. We can do things together that make it possible for us to do things as individuals, just as we can do things as individuals that make it possible for us to do things together. And I think some of the most significant things about today's readings, not only with Judas contrasted with Mary, but also with Peter contrasted with Judas. Because the only difference between Peter and Judas is that Peter could accept forgiveness. He could look back in Jesus' eyes and weep bitterly and have remorse, but accept the love of forgiveness that was offered him. Judas didn't do that. And that made all the difference. Now, if you take them, Mary and Judas, you see that the key thing for Mary was the love. And the key thing for, oh no, sorry, Mary and Peter I meant. The key thing for Peter was the ability to let go and accept the forgiveness. Doesn't it strike you that that's quite like what I gave you at the beginning when I spoke about Jesus coming, both for remedial purposes and also out of the unity of love? Both perspectives are needed. We're not focused on Mary primarily because she's a sinner, because only in one gospel is the woman who anoints Jesus' feet, namely Luke's, spoken of as a sinner. In all others, she is not spoken of in that way. So what singles her out really is the closeness in love to Jesus. And she understands him both individually, and she understands what he's about. If you contrast Judas and Peter, you find that you could say that Judas represents the kind of person that Oscar Wilde once talked about, the cynic who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing, the person who quantifies and measures. He sold Jesus. He saw him as a consumable, a saleable article. He represents the worst in a consumerist and thing-centered mentality, whereas Mary, although she spent money, she did it in a lavish gesture of love, which shows that generosity triumphing over greed, and that exercise of excess that characterizes God's way of dealing with us as well, is a different kind of challenge altogether to the culture. And so that's why I talk of the two of them. I'm skipping a few things because you don't want to be here all night. I should look at the time, shouldn't I? Oh, I'd say that's enough for today, wouldn't you? I could send you away with something, something that you could reflect on. Would you be happy if I did that? And I'll take up again with tomorrow. What I've really been saying is that we human beings, we live in an unsaved condition. And if it were left to ourselves, between our own faults and the kinds of social circumstances that we create, and the sort of things that face us that are beyond us in size, we would have very little reason for hope. But all of this week, we focus on somebody who was so focused on us that all of the actions he engages in are for the purpose of saving us. And saving has two components: healing and making whole. There is redemption, saving from, and there is salvation, saving for, so that you might have positive things, new life, energy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now my guess is, and that's why I'm going to ask you to focus on this, that in your own lives, you have both received increments of salvation, where you said to yourself, oh, thank God. And also occasionally increments of the opposite, of course. But I'm not interested in those right now, because if you focus on the increments of salvation you have received, and also on the ways in which you have occasioned other people's receiving of those increments of salvation, you will be much closer to focusing on God's activity, because God's activity is always good. What I mean is something like this. Did you ever receive forgiveness and understanding when you didn't really expect it? When you dared to hope for it, but it was beyond yourself to give it to you, and the person that you hurt said, it's okay. The pleasurable pain that follows from such a readmission to another person's heart, which you get as a gift. That, I think, is a little increment of salvation from God through the other person. Did you ever remember, going back to the romanticism at the beginning of the talk, that Dante said of Beatrice when he saw her in the streets of Florence, that she was his salvation? To love another person is to see the face of God. Another human face can also be a window on the salvation that God offers us. Did somebody ever do something for you, just out of the blue, without any quid pro quo, that you neither asked for, expected, or deserved? And when you tried to repay it, they said, no, I'm just happy to do it. Another little flash or increment of salvation. Did you ever attend a liturgy, come in with a closed heart and a sense of impossibility, and leave with a little more wings to your feet? What I'm trying to do is just recall those moments in life when, where it all seemed dark, some light emerged. I believe that that is God working through others, as he worked preeminently through Jesus, to place in your life what I'm calling an increment of salvation. What makes all the difference. Now I'm asking you to reflect on that, if you'd like, and just look to see, rummage in your history, to see when that happened. Because you'll be close to what God is doing for us in Jesus this week. But I'm also asking you then to rummage once again in your history, to ask yourself the more difficult question. When were you an occasion of God's being able to give something to somebody in a way that was liberating and freeing and hope-giving? We don't like to do this too much. We imagine that we're not that important. We think it might be arrogant to think about ourselves in those ways. But Christ has no other hands but yours. Nobody now but yours. You know that hymn? So I think that as well as being the recipient of increments of salvation, one is also the channel sometimes of that to other people. It might be appropriate, at least between today and tomorrow, if you're coming back tomorrow, which you're free not to, of course, but to think about those, because to make salvation real, we need to make it concrete. We can't just be talking about things that are beyond the human mind to imagine, especially when God became human and actually offers moments of salvation through the most ordinary of human things, like breaking bread and spilling wine and saying, "This is my body given for you." Sorry if I went on a bit long. Okay.
Josh.